Good morning and welcome
Love
to Continuous
Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Continue for Truth Radio. If everyone would please stand, face the flag, put your hand over your heart. Red.
I remember a teacher that I had. Now, I went through the seventh grade. I went to the seventh grade. I left home when I was 10 years old because I was hungry. I work in the summer and I go to school in the winter. But I had this one teacher. He was the principal of the Harrison School in Vincennes, Indiana. To me, this was the greatest teacher, a real sage of my time, anyhow. He had such wisdom. And we were all reciting the Pledge of Allegiance one day. And he walked over, this little old teacher, Mr. Laswell was his name. Mr. Laswell, he says, I've been listening to you boys and girls recite the Pledge of Allegiance all semester, and it seems as though it's becoming monotonous to you. If I may I recite it and try to explain to you the meaning of each word? I, me, an individual, a committee of one, pledge, dedicate all of my worldly goods to give without self-pity, allegiance, my love and my devotion, to the flag, our standard, O glory, a symbol of freedom, wherever she waves, there's respect, because your loyalty has given her a dignity that shouts, freedom is everybody's job. United. That means that we have all come together. States. Individual communities that have united into 48 great states. 48 individual communities with pride and dignity and purpose. All divided with imaginary boundaries, yet united to a common purpose, and that's love for country. And to the Republic, a state in which sovereign power is invested in representatives chosen by the people to govern. And government is the people, and it's from the people to the leaders, not from the leaders to the people, for which it's stands. One nation, meaning so blessed by God, indivisible, incapable of being divided, with liberty, which is freedom, the right of power to live one's own life without threats, fear, or some sort of retaliation, and justice, the principle or qualities of dealing fairly with others. For all. Which means, boys and girls, it's as much your country as it is mine. And now, boys and girls, let me hear you recite the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Since I was a small boy, two states have been added to our country, and two words have been added to the Pledge of Allegiance, under God. Wouldn't it be a pity if someone said that is a prayer? And that would be eliminated from schools, too.
Welcome to Saturday Symposium with Dan Wilson. Yeah, thank you, Red. We need that. We need that a lot. You know, he probably made some powerful words. We brand new news this morning that a guy was flying his flags at his apartment complex, and they just came and took them down, put them in bags, and set them on his front porch. You know, and sometimes those things, you know, sometimes it's because somebody just really they really don't want to cooperate, but sometimes it's because they really there's somebody there that wants to take that flag down, And it happens every couple of weeks. It happens, and it goes viral, and then they decide they've stepped in a too big of a mud pile, and they back down. They're already in the story working on trying to find a solution to it. But there are people out there that if Red Skelton were alive today, he'd probably be ashamed that not only do they most of the time not say the Pledge of Allegiance, but that the little boys and the little girls can go in the little boys and little girls' restrooms in California now, legally signed by the governor. You know, it's just insane. But that's where we start this morning, and we look back at Red Skelton a little bit. You know, he had a great career, and he always had some great things to say and some great illustrations. He was a back-to-the-basics kind of guy. We appreciate opening up with him this morning and give him tribute for that. This is going to be a great show, guys. We are going to really, really have a good, entertaining couple of hours. A couple of weeks ago, we had Dan's dad on, and he was not feeling good. There was flu going around everywhere. It was out here in California. It was back east. And he just wasn't feeling good. And we got him for a short time, and we've got him today for the full time of the show. And we're excited about that. We look at people that have been there and done that. And Dan's dad has been there and done that. And we're looking forward to inviting him on. This is Continuing for Truth Radio. We do a variety of shows. On Friday, we study the Old Testament, sitting down at Betty's table with Ladies Bible Class here in Springville, California. And on Mondays, occasionally we have politics and religion. Don't tell me I can't mix them. When we have a guest to sit down and interview Tuesday nights, every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock California time, it's 10 o'clock Eastern time. We sit down, Dan and I and Rodney Stanhope from out here in California, and Stacy Toblish and Jennifer Montrose from down in Alabama, and we talk politics, and we talk sovereignty, and we talk common sense, and we talk faith. And you won't want to miss that if you tune in every Tuesday night by faith. And let me tell you, you don't have to wait. You can go to the website right now. You're listening. It may be possibly on the website right now, or you're listening in archive. You can just go through the archives and go back to our past shows and see what we did. Everything's there, mistakes and all. Everything is there. And you can go back and listen to those previous shows also Thursday nights. We are no longer hosting the Free Don Miller Show. We have decided to take that back to the underground hard drive and put our efforts all back together. Steve Williams is decided no longer. He doesn't want to do New Stalker. He really wants to focus on Don Miller. And some great things are happening. The Wisconsin Innocence Project is about ready to take it to court. And I believe this is the last domino that we have to push over. I really believe we're going to see this innocent man come home to his family before Christmas. We're going to do everything we can. If you don't know anything about that story, you need to. If it can happen in Hurley, Wisconsin to Don Miller, it can happen to you too. And that's what makes it important. And you can go to an anatomyofawrongfulconviction.com. That's an anatomyofawrongfulconviction.com. And you'll find the links to the podcast, to the radio shows, to all of the court documents, interviews. There is a wealth of information that has been gathered over 15 years on this case in Hurley, Wisconsin. You've got the only way I can describe it, and this is the way I describe it, you have to start with a real bad Duke lacrosse case. Remember that, where the girl accused the boys of rape, and then after it went so far, she said, oh, no, it never really did happen. And their lives were ruined. And she's had problems ever since. Well, you start with that case. That's kind of where Don Miller starts. But then you've got to add to it the Dukes of Hazzard meets Perry Mason in the red light district. And I'm going to tell you, I'm a firm believer. I've been since I first started hearing about this, that one of these days it's going to be a made-for-TV movie. Actually, there's so much to it could be a miniseries. Because the story is insane. The sheriff steals, and then when he gets caught stealing from the city, he says, I didn't realize it was against the law. You've got that kind of a mentality. You've got a judge who was having a relationship with the victim before, during, and after the case. You've got a DA with no backbone that's in all kinds of problems, and has been his entire career. And it's all come down to a man sitting in prison for 15 years now, out of a 42-year sentence, of something that if he had been guilty, if he had really, really been guilty, and I don't believe for 5 seconds he was, it would have amounted to date rape. It would have amounted to a rape on a live-in a live-in woman who'd spent most of her time partying. She was living with Don. And so if he was guilty, I would be all for the punishment. But 42 years is a long time if he was guilty, and I think evidence proves not. So we want to encourage you to go there. Go to the Underground Hard Drive now on Thursdays at 7 o'clock, and Steve Williams and I will continue doing what we've done for 2 years. I want to make sure that we give out that shout-out. Dan, we are going to have an absolutely great time tonight, this afternoon. I want you to pull off, and your dad hasn't called in yet. We expect him here in the next couple of minutes. But I want to let you give your opening remarks and introduce your dad to tell us a little bit about him, his experience. We're going to look at a lot of things tonight. I want to talk to him a lot about the U-2 and the Apollo missions. There's some great history right there. And my mom and my grandfather were also involved through Lockheed Martin. And so I'm looking forward to that. Your dad also has got great ties, political ties, of people he's met over the years and different people he's been involved with. We're going to look at that some this morning. And then let me tell you, folks, there's no better person that I've seen so far qualified to talk about global warming. And let me tell you, we're going to glean his brain. We're going to have a great time. Dan, it's your dad. It's not too often we can turn around and in a group of people like we're looking to interview on this show. And your dad just happens to be one of them. And that says great things. And looking forward to it, I'm going to let you take it away and give your opening remarks.
Okay, well, of course, I'm very proud of him and what he's managed to achieve in his life. My dad came from a working class family. His father was worked in a manufacturing company. And during the 30s, the height of the Depression, he grew up with almost no food on the table. And he had a dream of going to college. And, of course, his family didn't have any money. And he decided that the only way he could do it was through a sports scholarship. And he excelled at football and got a scholarship at State University in New York when the Korean War broke out. And he joined the Navy and became a weatherman. So his time spent during the Korean War was as a weatherman. Afterwards, he went to St. Bonaventure for a while, then back to State University of New York. He could have gone on to a professional career in football, but his goals were in science and mathematics. He went on to work at General Dynamics with the Electric Boat Division in Groton, Connecticut, and was involved in the building of the first nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarine called the USS George Washington, where he worked on the reactor coolant system, and that's when I was born. After that, he left EB and went to work for Pratt & Whitney Aircraft, and he was involved in, this is where he got involved with the U-2 program, and also the Apollo program. When he was asked to lead a design team on the human factor of the Apollo program, meaning everything that the astronauts like going to the bathroom, food, all that whole aspect was his department. And as I said, they won the design, but not the manufacturing aspect of the program. From there, he went on to a think tank called Neptune Research Labs, where he finished up his PhD in mechanical engineering, and then went on to teach at the University of Rhode Island, where he did a major research project on oil spills and the effects of dispersants on oil spills, and had a very illustrious career there at URI, plus did a lot of consulting with natural gas companies. He holds 14 patents, including one that's used for filtration systems on oil tankers. He's quite an incredible man. And after he retired, this global warming thing came up, and because his specialty is what they call fluid mechanics, which that's the atmosphere. Our atmosphere, we're actually breathing a fluid. It's just a very, has a very low viscosity. So what happens in the atmosphere happens inside the water, and the same kind of movements and interactions. Plus his background as a weatherman leads him to be an expert in the field of global warming and the effects on it. And he, on his own, did a research project and put together a video on it. And but at the time, the media was so into this global warming fiasco that people didn't listen to the scientists and knew what they were talking about. Instead, they'd get these people on the Discovery Channel or something like that who has a PhD in physics, which has nothing to do with weather, or PhD in geology, and these people are supposedly talking as experts on weather, which was crazy. So this is how this global warming thing got all out of hand. A few people made a lot of money out of it, but the fact of the matter is, it is, from a scientific perspective, there is no true evidence leading towards it. And from there, we'll start off, and here he is, I guess. And has he called in?
Yes, he has. I'm here, and I want to welcome you. We want to thank you for taking time to spend some time to chat with us, and we're going to just have fun listening to stories and having good discussion. I really enjoyed getting to know you a little bit from Dan, and we're looking forward to it. You know, Dan gave a great quick bio for you. So I really want to get in, you know, and really look at three different aspects of your life. I want to eventually look at what you've been doing recently. But I want to talk a little bit about the U-2 and the Apollo mission. You know, my grandfather and my mother both worked for Lockheed. And during the Apollo mission my grandfather did and the space shuttle, and it always fascinated me as a kid. I'm looking forward to some great stories from that. And you know, you spent some time in the political world. Anytime you step foot onto a university, you know you're on an electric, a big electric piece of frying pan. And then you're an expert on global warming, and we're looking forward to having some discussion about that. So I'm going to hand it to you for opening remarks and some chit-chat, and you and Dan talk a little bit. I'm going to just sit back and listen, and then let's get deep into the U-2 and the Apollo mission. Well, Dan, I'm sorry about that. Mason, it's all yours.
Okay, thanks. It's great meeting you. I had a nice talk with you the last time and so on, but I'd like to correct Dan's a little bit of where I did the Apollo work. Actually, I was in the chemical engineering group at Electric Boat, and it's a group that I headed up there, and we were bidding in with Convair Astronautics. We was co-bidding them with Convair Astronautics because they wanted a bid for the whole Apollo mission. And so our bid went in with that. Well, North American ended up with the contract, but they liked my proposal so much that they awarded the environmental part to us at Electric Boat. And when we got that contract, I went to my boss and said, well, I'm going to manage this. And he says, no, I'm going to manage it. And I don't think he even read the proposal. And I says, well, okay. That's when I went to Pratt & Whitney. But anyway, it was an exciting time. It was great because back then we did not know how things would behave in zero gravity. We had a postulate. And in fact, the whole Apollo mission, the whole space program, was done on the imagination of engineers and good physical and logical reasoning. And it's quite a wonder that the space program has been as successful as it has been. It has been the source of many new sciences in communications, navigation, whatever you name it, the computer. It really was a burst to American engineering and innovation. And we are here where we are today because of many of those very bright minds that I had the pleasure of growing up with. And I just have had a fun career. I wish everybody could have a fun career like I have. So that's it about Apollo. The U2 bit was, I didn't have much to do with that at all. When I had Pratt & Whitney in Advanced Power Systems, he used to call me on me to do solve some problems. And one time they sent me down to their plant in Florida, okay, West Palm Beach. They had a manufacturing plant there, and they wanted me to look at, I forget even the problem, I think it was a bearing problem or something. And so they wanted me to take a look at it, and I walk into this room, and we got a canvas over this big jet engine, and a little hole there, a cutout, so where I would take a look. Well, when I looked inside that hole think about the problem, and I found out they had all of their hydraulic tubing on was gold-plated and finned. Well, and we went and discussed the problem. I forget what the outcome, it's so long ago. But then I had found out that it was the U-2, and Pratt & Whitney would make the engine in West Palm Beach, put it in a panel truck with it closed, and leave it in a parking lot somewhere in Texas, and then the people from Lockheed would come and pick it up. They never saw each other, so they never could connect with each other. And that's how the U-2 was formed. I didn't know it was all that until one of the YouTube got shot down by Gary Powers. So that's my involvement in those two programs. And what else would you like to ask?
Now, what was your involvement with Wright Pat? I know you knew Mr. Patterson pretty well.
I'm trying to remember. I was out there in some things. And I don't know who I was out there for. I worked with the Air Force on developing laser. This is when we were using aluminum dioxide. And we were growing crystals anyway. And the crystals were being, I did this with a chemical engineering professor. And we were for lasers. And this is when lasers was being research being done by the Air Force, and they were going two areas. One is a crystal way developing the laser, and then the gas. And they find out the gas was much better, and that ended that research. I did use the crystal was very nonlinear structurally and thermally, and it was a very difficult problem trying to predict on how how to grow it from a seed to a full crystal big enough to be used in a laser system. Anyway, that's how I got involved a lot with the Air Force. So,
and that's where you got to meet Mr. Patterson. And when you ended up in the Wright Patt Museum for their
that story goes back to we have a discussion group in Florida in the when we get back there in the wintertime, and we got a whole group of people there, and I became friends with a retired Air Force general, and it was he is cited in the museum there at Wright-Patterson. And quite a fella. He's dead now. But we had a lot of nice discussions that we had in our group, the president of a bank, you know, the retired general. We had Russ, which is a retired business and business professor. And we had quite a host of people. So one other guy who worked, he never could talk about his work, but he worked for the State Department and going on all the embassies and making sure they weren't bugged and so on. So we've been up to having a good group of people talking. We still continue. But that's how I think I mentioned when I talked about Wright-Patterson. It was this retired general that was mentioned in the history of the Air Force. I forget what he did, but he's on display there at the Wright-Patterson Museum in Flying.
Yeah, and I remember that when growing up, when you worked and made that filter system for the oil tankers.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I got into the filter system because my first really big million-dollar program, research program, was an electric boat. And it started out with some fella came down to my boss's office, and he had a valve, and it was charred. And what did we think about it? Well, my boss didn't know what to say, so he sent him over to me. And we had a little talk, and he says, well, how important is it? I said, well, it could probably blow up your high-pressure air system. Wow, he liked that. And so I ended up, he says, well, can you prove it? Well, I went down and I got a long pipe, a dead-end pipe, and I sprayed some hydraulic fluid. The hydraulic fluid is supposed to be non-flammable. But when you get up to 4,500 pounds, you're talking that almost, in terms of explosion capability, the concentration of oxygen atoms, which has to do with how fast something burns, is high enough to be almost like 200-pound pure oxygen, okay, or more. So the environment was there, and so I ended up in, I had everybody, soup ships, the damnos, and everybody around my boss for the big test. We opened up the solenoid valve quickly, remotely, of course. It was an explosion-proof thing. Ba-boom. And so that's how I got into hazards in high-pressure air systems, and that led to trying to keep the oil out of the high-pressure air systems, which led to my involvement in patenting filters. But looking back at that, I was very, very lucky because I couldn't reproduce that every time. It just happened that time really well, and didn't happen too many other times, so... It's a very interesting project where I was very, very lucky, and I immediately became high profiled. And that's why I did a lot of time in Washington and all over the place.
And then once you went to URI, I remember that oil spill project you did when you took out the research vessel Endeavor on her maiden voyage. And maybe we can go into that a little bit.
It's interesting. When I first got to URI, see Neptune Research, primarily in flow measurement, and I was still consulting with them afterwards, and we got a nice big contract with American Gas Association to look at the accuracy of orifice plates on metering of the gas flow. And so that's where my involvement with Dr. Dardell, we did that together. And I had a lot of papers there, and I even received the American Gas Association Award for all the number of papers I presented to them. But anyway, that's my beginning. And this was, I did, so that's why I did a lot of consulting in flow management. And I even taught the ISA course worldwide on that, on flow management. But then I could see that was sort of coming to an end, and I looked at something else. Well, my work with oil and oil filters led me to, I think I responded to, it was, let's see, not, it was Energy Research, ERDA, was, and that was preceded the Department of Energy. And I don't know if they had an RFP or not, but I wrote to them saying that, I, you know, I'd like to develop a filter. No, they were asking somebody to look at the, to do a general survey of all the techniques to clean up oil spills and mitigate the impact. And so I did get a study for that. Now that study, I came up with this thing on the oil pollution using dispersions to mitigate the impact of oil spills on especially intertidal zones where all the marine life almost has its origins. And so that was quite a large contract. I ended up so many years. I had 30 people working with me on that, and had a lot of fun with it. And that's why I did an awful lot of work on pollution. Interesting thing about that is that we were the first to respond on the Endeavors. In fact, the Endeavor just came from the Great Lakes where it was built, and into dock, and I went out on its first research mission on Georges Bank, and that was to look at the impact of the Argo Merchant, and we got out there, we couldn't find any oil at all, no matter what. But we found a big storm. Big superstorm that sunk the Grand Zenith, it's a big super tanker. Now, they never even got a signal off that. We were maybe 100 miles away from them in the same storm. And so, North Sea is not nice. North Atlantic is not nice in the wintertime. Anyway, that's how I got into the oil pollution bit.
Yeah, and I remember cleaning those tanks.
That was to we were doing wave actions on that day and trying to look how the mechanism on how the oil gets entrained into the water column and how deep it goes. And that's what those experiments were. And what we were trying to do, I was trying to do, is come up with a model for how an oil spill impacts the environment. But it was supposed to be a spatial model. And mathematical, and it would take all these effects in, like the wave effect. We'd look at the bacterial degradation. We wanted to look at the effect of the oil spill on microorganisms. And in fact, it was one of the fellow I hired was a marine biologist. He looked at the impact of the predator-prey relationship between starfish and the oyster drill and scallops. And he found out that when in the presence of oil and the dispersant, the scallop was not able to detect a predator cell. And I think we probably were one of the first ones to look at the predator-prey relationships in the environment caused by a hazard like an oil spill.
Mm-hmm. And then it was your experience... I guess we have to jump back so we can show how you went into global warming. Was your time in the Navy when you became a weatherman, and how did that all come about?
Well, that came about because as a weatherman in the service, and once you get seemed to interested in weather, it's all around us, so you study it the rest of your whole life, whether you like it or not. And you know how I showed you the different signs of approaching weather and how to handle it on the boat.
Right.
Because it was great. You need to be able to predict the weather if you're out in a sailboat. And so I kept up with the weather for a long time. I was a member of the American Meteorological Society. In fact, when I got out of service, I almost went to business with Ray Faulkner, who was a member of the GE research team on global on cloud seeding. And him and I were going to go into the business of global, forecasting weather, et cetera. I was a member of the American Meteorological Society, and I'm not sure they had anything to do how they sanction weather forecasters or not, but that we were going to do that. But I was married then, and the kids, and I didn't have any money, and I was afraid to take the chance. Well, Ray went out to be the weatherman for the local region, the Norway Schenectady area, and was a professor then at Sunny Albany in environmental work. And so that's how I really got, I stayed in weather. I didn't really get into global warming until about when I retired. And I retired in 95, and this is when the IPCC and all of them were coming out, these great predictions. And there's great heightened response to all the global warming bit. And one of my specialties, of course, is radiation heat transfer. And they're talking about the greenhouse effect and so on. Well, geez, we got to remember that the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is only 350 parts per million. That actually is pretty low to have such a large effect. And certainly from a radiation standpoint, it didn't make any sense that that wasn't heating up the environment. Certainly the concentration wasn't there. And you got to remember CO2, people don't realize that CO2 is the base, is the basis of life. Okay, we need CO2 to grow vegetables and so on. We breathe in CO2 at about maybe 0.03% of the atmosphere that we breathe in is CO2, but we breathe in the oxygen and we exhale about 4 to 5%. Well, that 4 to 5% is in the neighborhood of 40 to 50,000 parts per million. Okay, so if you put that in perspective, and mankind is not affected by the concentration of CO2 until it gets up into that region anyway. So, and remember that there's a lot of balances in the carbon cycle. If we produce more carbon dioxide, the plants absorb more carbon dioxide. It's also dissolved, it's released from the ocean as the temperature increases. But if the concentration increases at the same temperature, you're driving more carbon dioxide to be in solution. If carbon dioxide in itself, they talk about they're going to give us more rain. Well, nature has a way of compensating for variations. And so, if it rains more, we produce more clouds, and the clouds reflect more sun. So, people don't realize that. I think as we go on through the day today, we'll find out that the global warming is more political than it really is. It's more hype than it really is of science. I can start that if you want to go back to the history of how global warming came about. I'll be glad to give you that and show you why it started off with a political bent.
Well,
I think that'd be an excellent idea. I want to give you a quick question, and then let's do that, because that's really kind of ties in with my question. And this is what my friends would say as a Scott being Scott question. You just walked into a group of five people, and you've got just a short amount of time to convince them that global warming is, the science proves that it isn't. What are the five best illustrations we've got that prove they're lying? One of my big ones is the fact that they never tell us that the Antarctic ice shelf is growing while the Arctic is shrinking. They only talk about one side. They don't mention it's being balanced out on the other side. What are the five things that you would put on the table and say this is the most that you can take to prove that global warming is political, it's not based on true science, so on and so forth. And then let's just start with the history of where all that came with, and you just take it away. I'm enjoying sitting here listening to you talk.
Okay, number one, you mentioned the Arctic. We happen to be approaching the minimum amount of ice cover in the Arctic right now. It's occurring right now. But it's occurring at a minimum that is much higher. In other words, less ice has melted in the Arctic in the last something like since 1980. Okay, so the Arctic is regaining itself, and probably will regain itself. Also, is back when I gave a talk on global warming, I had mentioned melting the glaciers from underneath. And there's a recent paper that came out. The Mid-Atlantic Rift goes up through Iceland and then goes northwest out of Ireland, parallel to the Greenland, and then goes up to Siberia, where they're all getting this warming. Okay, and I suspect that when they really look into it, they found out that most of this warming and melting actually come from lava and the heat from the inner part of the Earth than it did from the the top side. So first of all, the Arctic is recovering, but it's the temperature and the melting of the Arctic is such a variable of all kinds of things. The wind. Remember, all the ice in the Arctic is over water. So consequently, any change in the currents within that water is going to change that ice flow. In fact, it can pull the ice away. And once it's broken, it can bring the ice down into warmer waters. So that's quite different than the Arctic. So the Arctic is really not a good example of anything but the dynamics of the ocean and the sun and a whole bunch of things we don't understand. It's a very, very poor example to prove that there's global warming, because so many things affect its behavior. And right now, it's very interesting that El Nino, La Nina, and all that, and we don't understand how the different currents in the ocean change, like the Gulf Stream, and that changes a little bit, or a Gulf eddy gets split off and goes up north or whatever. We don't understand that. Anybody thinks they can predict that is unfounded. They don't have the ability to do it. It's not there. So the Arctic in itself is a poor example, and Greenland to indicate global warming. The dynamics are quite different than they are in the Arctic. In Antarctic. The Antarctic, you've got a continent. So except for the fringes between South America and the Antarctic, it's all on land, and so consequently, the Antarctic is very easily not affected by the currents like the Arctic is. They did have some breaking off of ice sheets there. I'm not sure whether it's in the Antarctic, but more ice you pile up on a mountain, the bigger the glaciers are, and more they have to calve. So that can be expected. Also, there's a divide there between with the plates that meet the just between South America and Antarctic too. So I don't know if there's any heating from underground there or not. But we have to take everything in effect, and it's very, very complex. That's the reason it's very hard to prove global warming. And it's very hard to disprove it, except that if you take a look at the data. I've been looking at that. I got data in front of me that shows that the carbon dioxide has increased with almost 50 parts per million in the last 10 or 15 years. And the temperature hasn't gone up. In fact, it's been pretty even for the last 15 years. Yet, if I take a look at the solar activity, and the solar activity and the temperature curves, they lay on top of each other. They change. If the solar activity increases, temperature increases. And if it decreases, it decreases. And there's a paper out now that shows the, from a Russian that says we're going to be cooling because the activity of sun, the discharges, is going to decrease. Solar flares will decrease. And so he's predicting a decrease in the overall temperature. But certainly what has happened is that the models used by IPCC in 1996 have not proven accurate at all. In fact, they've proven very wrong. That should be proof enough that their alarmism is simply alarmism, and it's not based on science. So that's that part of it. But to talk about global warming in terms of this history of it, it started back in 1957 as a Roger Revelle. He was a director of the Scripps Oceanography and Institute, and Hans Assus, a chemist from the University of Chicago, published a joint paper about the possibility of carbon dioxide causing global warming. Well, what had happened is that this Roger Revelle used to do research for the Navy, looking for the fallout of the atomic tests in the Pacific at that time. And when that program ran out, the Navy sort of awarded them a goodbye contract by giving them money to look into CO2 and so on. We remember back then in the 50s and the activism that we had all the, they called them the tree huggers, that were the people climbing the trees so they couldn't be cut down in the forest and so on. And those two things were natural for one another. And so when environmental was picked up, the global warming bit, they hugged the tree because they didn't want them cut down. There was against capitalism. And this was one way to get back at capitalism. So from an environmental standpoint, as soon as global warming was mentioned, they grabbed onto it and used that also to get at the capitalists. We're not going to break your back by not letting you use coal and cheap energy and so on. That's kind of reckless because it's cheap energy which we manufacture our goods. And if the energy is not cheap, our goods are not cheap, and nobody's going to buy them. But anyway, that's how it started back in 1957. Now, in 1960, there is a fellow, a U.N. diplomat, a Canadian U.N. diplomat named Michael Strong. And he was really back wanting a world government. You know, of course, everybody wants a world government, pushes for it so that when they get it, they might be the big cheese. And planned to use this global warming thing and at the UN, and he proclaimed Earth Day event in Sweden in 1970 and demanded a CO2 tax and a tax for the industrial nations was to help developing nations. And that's how the whole IPCC concept was formed. Now, did that have anything to do with science? No, it didn't. And then in 1996, the UN IPC reported CO2 is causing global warming. Okay. There was only 52 scientists on that panel. There were 948 diplomats issued the report. And many of those scientists disagreed with the final report, did not have a time to read it or comment on it. And so when you talk about thousands of scientists, it's a lie. There's very few scientists on board. And, you know, that's the cause of Al Gore's 1,000 scientists remark, and it's an outright lie. It wasn't. There were diplomats. And Diplomats usually don't make good scientists. Then, of course, we had the 2009 Climate Gate, where we found out that an awful lot of this stuff was fake. And in 2009, only 20% of the IPCC scientists deal with climate. See, there's a lot of these things are voted, and science doesn't belong to, in a democratic society. You don't vote whether the science is right or not. You can vote legislation, but you can't vote Newton's laws of gravity away. They just won't go. And they make poor scientists then. Now, in 2009, even noted meteorologist Dr. Neil Franks, he was the former head of the NOAA Miami Hurricane Center. He stated that global warming is a scam. Okay, I mean, and I've had very high regards for this Dr. Neil Franks, one of the most outstanding meteorologists in the century. So we didn't have all the big scientists agreeing with global warming, and in fact, very few of them did. And since 1998, in defiance of predictions of the IPCC, global temperatures for 2007 was the coolest in a decade and the coldest of the millennium. So now that's why they changed global warming to climate change. Interesting topics, isn't it?
Okay. Well, this one thing that never made sense to me, and this involved a squadron of aircraft that were being ferried over to Europe during World War II. It was three B-17s. Followed by a squadron of P-38s, and they ran out of fuel before they could get to their next refueling spot, and they had to force land in 1944 onto the top of a glacier in Greenland. Now, about a decade ago, a group of aviation enthusiasts went up there to try to recover these aircraft. And they managed to get one P-38. Her name is Glacier Girl. But they had to go down over 270 feet under the snow and ice to get to it. So that means that between 1944... and present, the ice cap in Greenland grew by almost 300 feet.
Yeah, but of course you get God. You know, these are glacial. Glaciers move, and the true, you add on to it, it gets larger, but they calve and they go off to sea. So that's certainly that's the reason the most of this stuff is much more complicated than the people think it is. And be very aware of anybody who predicts very much in the future. We can't even tell you in the springtime how many hurricanes we're going to have and what that's going to happen to them. You know, if we could predict climate, why couldn't we do that? We can't get even close to it. And in fact, the best prediction for hurricane activity is historical records. Not anything to do with the physics of the system. So it's very complicated. And the only thing is that there has not, the science tells us, there's not been any significant warming in the last 15 years. And that should convince anybody that the predictions behind global warming is not good. It's wrong.
What about the ice core samples that...
I'll talk about that. The first ice core sample that came out, they tried to show that CO2 led the temperature. Okay? And actually, in a couple parts of it, you think they do. The second ice core always showed carbon dioxide lagged the temperature. Okay? and the temperature went up, then the carbon dioxide went up, not the vice versa. Of course, nobody ever wants to talk about that, who's in favor of global warming. People have a great propensity to believe in what they want to hear and discard all the other facts. It's like there's politics and then there's facts. And people just don't want to hear about it. They turn it off. And so they lose a lot of the science that's going forth, the real things that are happening. And you got to remember that global warming is a big market. NASA liked it, and I used to respect NASA scientists greatly. I don't anymore, because the bigger the NASA gets, the more money they get from Congress, the bigger clout they have, and everybody gains by it. The same way as the university research. Oh, if I can bring in all this money, I'm going to be great, and that promoted, and all the other things. So this is. Global warming has been prostituting the scientists and saying and doing things that have not been right. And in fact, today, right now, it's very difficult for me to believe in temperatures recorded at all. Just recently, on my Facebook, I posted an article there where National Weather Service had to close 600 sites. You know why? Because they put the thermometers on parking lots and they put them where there's great big heat sinks to increase the temperature. Now that's patently wrong, and we know the government can do that. we see what's happening in the country today. So some of it's fabricated. Very little of it is real. Now we do want to know that over the the last couple of hundred years, the temperature of the Earth has been increasing somewhat, all right, and it might continue for a little while because the Earth is warming up to a certain extent, but that's mostly done by the sun and the normal warming of the Earth. So and that's nothing to be excited about. It's nothing that is going to cause great rises in sea level. Are great increases in temperatures. You know, a couple of tens of 3 or 4 tenths of a degree for 100 years is not bad at all. I'm not going to worry about it because I won't be here any. But just this is a thought of some people, including our own government, trying to control carbon dioxide to decrease temperature is absolutely asinine. First of all, our production of CO2 has gone down in the last 4 or 5 years. Because our business is going down, but it rises because developing nations like China and so on are going to burn coal. Now, if we think that we can spend big money, something like 28 cents per kilowatt hour for wind power and a similar price for solar power, and try to work against 4 or 5 cents per kilowatt hour for nuclear or coal or gas, we can't compete like that. You know, we think why this country can't put things together is because all the electric costs have gone up because the government forced these electric companies to pay for these expensive power sources, the solar and wind, and you can't do that. And expect that you're going to have a vibrant manufacturing base. So we're nobody's going to trust. Noah's not on. I mean, China's not on to the global one. Neither is Russia or anybody else. So if we do it, we do it at the cost of our economy and really the existence of this government. And that's how stupid that old move is.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's amazing that we have to rely right now on Russia and China to be the common sense, you know? And I want to kind of frame, first of all, we're at the top of the hour. I want to remind everybody this is Saturday Symposium with Dan Wilson. Each Saturday we do this. This is Contending for Truth Radio. And, you know, you've talked about a lot of things, but here's what I've gleaned from it. You're a problem solver. You've gone for most of your life, you've sat down and you've looked at a series of things laying out on the desk, and you've had to kind of put them together and see where they fit and solve some problems. But the big portion of what has made you successful is you've start out with the thought that, number one, man doesn't know as much as he thinks he knows and never will. And you look at it as if you've got to solve something. So when you go back and you look at some of the history of global warming, it's blatantly obvious. You see it straight away that it's not being done for the purpose they're saying it's being done for. It's a lie. And, you know, we've got so many of these things that we've got in our hand. I learned some new things already about global warming and arguing it. I've been debating global warming for 10, 15 years. At different times, I've had some long, long, drawn-out conversational debates on blogs about global warming. But when it all comes down to it, we have got in our hands a huge political tool if we wanted to use it. It's kind of like Don Miller on Thursday night. It's blatantly obvious that this is a lie. It's not because we've got some details that are missing. It's blatantly obvious that it was done for a purpose. And it was done by using lying to accomplish the task. And I wish our candidates would pick this snowball up and use it in their campaigns, if they marched down the road and said what was truth, and let the American people understand, you know, science at one time thought the world was flat. And science throughout history has always thought they're right on the edge of the next answer. But when it comes down to it in the different sciences, there's more that you don't know than what you do know, and you're putting together pieces like that. And for you to be able to do that and function, come up with some functional items like the oil filters that you were talking about, and doing different projects and solving problems is something that I think is great. So I want to pass it back to you and let you comment on that a little bit and keep on going. You and Dan are doing a great job. I'm sitting here listening and taking notes. We're going to use this this next week. I homeschool part-time my three nieces, and we're going to use this next week. We've discussed global warming some, and we've discussed that science, and we're going to use that. So I want to give you as much opportunity as you can to just keep on talking. So I'm going to pass it back to you for that and let you and Dan just keep going.
One question I had was on plate tectonics and how the ocean currents change and how these variations of ocean currents affect the weather, like El Nino and La Nina. And see, this is another aspect of weather that that people don't understand. I've had some experience with the Gulf Stream going, you know, delivering boats up and down the coast. And as you were saying, there's eddies that come off. And just trying to predict those eddies, where they're going to be in a matter of a week is basically impossible. And, you know, how do they interact with the weather also, the ocean currents?
The whole system is tied together, Dan. El Nino, La Nina are upwelling and downwelling of the ocean, the change in temperature. When they come, the science in predicting when they come and where they go is almost minimal to non-existent. We can't even predict what El Nino is going to do in a month. These currents certainly change all the ocean currents. You change the ocean currents, you change in the whole temperature distribution in the world, because most of the world is covered with water. And so certainly it affects the climate, and it has to affect the climate. And that's the reason why when I talked about the Arctic, the ocean currents have a big and the wind has a big effect on whether the Arctic ice stays in there or not, because the ice is on water. And so that's why it's so unpredictable. and so variable. Okay, when you're if you're on a land mass, you have a little bit better. You have a little bit more of a constant base to work with. But the ocean is not, and it's extremely complicated. And some, and I'm sure that none of these climate models are sophisticated enough to even think about that, not only to include it. But it's interesting. The one thing I haven't pointed out probably as much as I should is that the sun is the driver for our temperature for the most part. As I said, I have solar activity with temperature. You can plot them on to the same map together. They almost look like the same curve. But Milinkovitch, he was a Polish scientist back in the 1930s, and done analysis. Now, this is without the big supercomputers. And he looked at the sun variation, the Earth's inclination, the distance from the sun, and so on. And he was able to show and predict the ice ages throughout all the millennia, as far as recorded history. And so and that convinced me at an early time that the solar behavior is the most influential thing on our weather. And in fact, when I was in college, I believe very much that the sun caused mostly our variation in temperature. And I was going to do a research program, and I went to Dr. Boss. He had a telescope in the Albany Observatory, and I was going to use the telescope to measure sun activity. But I never had the money or the time to do it, and I was busy doing everything else. But back then I thought, and I still think, and the data shows, the climate is driven primarily by the sun, a variation in everything, much more so than any other single factor. That's a really important to realize. It'd be interesting what's going to happen in the next 5 years. We're supposed to get a little cooler. We've had one of the coldest Julys that we've had recorded. This past winter was one of the coldest recorded. So, and in 200 years. So we have, there's a lot of things that are happening, and hopefully people are going to realize that this is wholly been a farce. But you got to remember, there's a class of people who are anti-capitalist, want to see things fail, want to blame man. And I don't care, you can show them all the facts in the world. They're not going to believe you. That's what makes the politics of global warming very, very difficult. It's just like when you listen to a politician. You know, if he's lying like mad, but you like him, you're going to believe him. Hitler said that. And Goring, they use it. You keep on repeating the same lie, people believe it pretty soon. Well, there's your case. There's your global warming. Let's get back to some of the politics, because I have something ahead of me now from the disc I made. The politics for cap and trade. And the charity, the Joyce Foundation, Obama was serving on its board of directors, and they gave about $1.1 million in two separate grants to launching a privately owned Chicago Climate Exchange. Okay, you ever heard of this Chicago Climate Exchange? Which now call itself the only North American cap and trade system for all six of the greenhouse gases, and has direct ties to Al Gore, Gore's investment company, Generation Investment Management, sells carbon offset opportunities, is the largest shareholder of this Chicago Climate Exchange. Notice it comes out of Chicago. Okay? Maurice Strong, who I had mentioned earlier, which was the UN ambassador, one of the UN diplomats from Canada that did this, was initiated at the Earth Summit. He was on the board of directors there, too. So, and besides cap and trade, Obama's campaign was heavily financed through companies like GE and so on. They would profit greatly if they went to the green technology, manufacturing wind turbines and so on. And incidentally, Spain has done this, gone this route for a global change that's gone to green energy and for some time. And for every job created in green technology area, 2.3 jobs were lost to the rest of the economy. Can you imagine that? That's what's going to happen in this country. We've already seen it. This past month, we've seen 137 or 167 part-time jobs. Okay, part of that's Obamacare. And companies are trying to cut back on what they're spending. And if your energy costs go up, you have to cut it back on help. The real income of American people has fallen. Okay, you wonder why? Here's your answer. All right here, right in front of you. Okay, so and I remember looking when Obama was being elected back at Chicago Cap and Trade. They had a Newsweek, and they said, "Oh, we're going to get Obama in there. We're going to make money like mad." Well, thank God, things slowed down enough. The Republicans were able to keep them in hold. That Chicago Cap and Trade don't exist anymore. So.
Solyndra was what? Another one.
Who?
Of his. Solyndra. It turned out that Obama's one of his campaign managers was the holding corp of a solar panel company called Solyndra that he used as an example of green energy. And he gave Solyndra $500 million, and less than 9 months later, the company went out of business, and that $500 million disappeared.
Obama's whole cabinet and everything else are either that type of purple green energy, but EPA, now EPA is going to force it with edicts, and they closed down a lot of the coal power plants and cost the nation and jobs tremendously. And we wonder why the nation is suffering. Green energy is the wrong way to go. And all you're doing is making energy more expensive and putting people out of work. Now, remember not too many years ago, there was the whole Copenhagen draft treaty. Remember that? Christopher Monckton, the former advisor to Margaret Thatcher, discovered in a note to the Secretariat that the treaty would set up a new world government. This is what Obama likes, too, remember? Clinton and Obama, they want the new world government to take away our guns and so on. And they say the aim of the new government is to have power to intervene in financial, economic, tax, environmental affairs of all the nations that signed the Copenhagen Treaty. You remember that? And Obama was for it. In fact, he went over there, remember? And each signing nation would pay an adaption fee. The U.S. was $140 billion per year, which would be distributed to developing nations. Yep, another Obama distributed the wealth program. So you see where the politics. Back then, one of the designers of the IPCC predictions is that data doesn't matter. This is by Reddit, R-E-D-D-I-T. But data doesn't matter. We're not basing our recommendations on the data. We're basing them on climate models. How do you like that? Professor Chris Follin, the Hadley Center for Climate Prediction and Research. The models are convenient fictions that provide something very useful. Yeah, to get one. Dr. David Frame, a climate modeler from Oxford University, said, it doesn't matter what is true. It's only what matters, what people believe is true. There you are. That's global warming. If you want to believe in it, you're on their side. Forget the facts. And Paul Watson, who was co-founder of the Greenpeace, says, unless we announce disasters, no one will listen. That's why all the hype about global warming, you know. Everybody listens. Everybody get all upset. We got to do something about it. Doesn't matter what it's right or wrong. So these environmentalists are real good politicians. Sir John Hewton, the first chairman of the IPCC, no matter if the science of global warming is all phony, Climate change provides the greatest opportunity to bring about justice and equality in the world. See what I mean? It's phony right from the very beginning. Its very existence starts off wrong. Okay? That's the term. Now, another interesting thing, I don't know if anybody ever heard the Club of Rome. If you haven't, look it up. It's extremely interesting. The Club of Rome is made up of about a lot of these people, the Stoics and so on. And they go along with the philosophy, the common enemy of humanity is man. In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. All these dangers are caused by human intervention, and it's only through changed attitudes and behavior can they be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself. And what a false statement that was. And this Club of Rome came out with saying, we've got to ride this global warming issue. If the theory is wrong, we'll be doing the right thing in terms of economic and environmental policy. Nothing to do with science. It's scary.
So, oh, yeah.
You can go on and on about different quotes from there. And that's why it's all politics.
Well, just me is... this thing on these electric cars, they did a study on the manufacturing of the batteries, and the CO2 emissions from the manufacturing process is equivalent to driving a regular car 90,000 miles before they equal out. As in carbon emissions. So electric cars do not even make any sense just because of
that. That doesn't make even sense even if that is true. Okay? Because where do they get the electricity from? Okay? Coal-fired power generator. Now, electric power is generated only at 37% or so efficient. Internal combustion engine is around 60%. And a diesel a little higher. Gas turbines are even higher. So to use electricity, the only way they can use electricity without increasing the carbon dioxide level, or way beyond what it should be, is if it's nuclear. So and there's no push for that. So the whole idea of electric car business is stupid. And the nice thing about electric cars is you don't pay a big tax on electricity you use, but you do when you buy the fuel. It's discombobulated the whole way. It's so fouled up that there's no logic to the whole system at all.
Oh, well, Scott, what are you paying per gallon because of taxes? Scott, are you there?
We're paying it's close to $4 a gallon where we're at, but if you go into LA or you go into San Francisco or some of the big cities, they're up close to $5 a gallon in different places. But it right up here we're still even a little bit high for some places up here, but we're under $4.
Jeez. That makes a good case for electric cars, doesn't it?
I know, huh? It sure does. And, you know, here's one of the things, and here's something I like about the gas industry. Number one,
yeah.
You know, Coke makes a better profit. But in California, one of the reasons why we've got such high gas prices is every single county has a different required mix. So you can't just take and leave the shop with the gallon of gas, with the tank of gas and bring it to Surrey County. It's got to be a specific mix, and it puts a lot of stress on the process of turning oil into gasoline, and thus makes our problem here. It's one of those embedded things that we talked about when we talk about the tax code, and you know, on top of that, we've got higher gas taxes out here in California. California loves to tax us on everything, but it's a mess.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're paying $3.32.
It sure is, and Yeah, I just happened to come up with one of the slides I use in my presentation. The contribution to the greenhouse effect. Actually, something like 96% of the greenhouse effect is done by water vapor. Water vapor. Why don't we ban water vapor? Eh? Okay, so how are you going to do it? Take all the water out of the air? it's strange. And very little bit of water vapor caused by man. And if you go down to all the methane and so on, there's so many methane releases that are occurring in the world. I mean, that and methane is far more troublesome than carbon dioxide. So that's the reason I almost choke when I hear these people, you know, blaming carbon dioxide all the things that problems that we're having. It's nowhere near. Our problems are much different than that.
Yeah, I was hearing that the number one methane producer in this country are cows.
That they could do a lot. But, you know, though, for years, now they don't do it, but for years, the oil industry and Saudi Arabia and so on, the natural gas, they didn't have anything to do with it, just left it up to the atmosphere. Another thing, too, about how global warming works, everybody takes it out who's trying to show global warming. Remember, they try to blame the hurricanes on global warming and everything else. Well, the World Meteorological Society about a couple months ago, part of our report said that the last decade was one of the hottest in so many years. They compared it with the coldest decade that remember the Icelandic volcanoes exploded, put a lot of ash in. Well, that made that decade one of the coolest. So that comparing two decades, you can select things all over the place to try to prove your point. But all of them are taken out of context. And I pity the poor public, knowledgeable public, who listens to this and they believe it. Of course they have to believe what was presented because it's true, but they don't realize how far it was taken out of context. Unless you have studied this whole thing carefully, can you begin to understand all of the fraud that's involved in it? And that's the sorry point of it. I'm not sure we can educate the public sufficiently enough for them to not to believe in a lot of these things that are coming out. And, of course, that they have a bent to want to believe in it. It's very hard to convince them not to believe in it. So there's the fundamental flaw in mankind that makes him want to continue to believe in the things that he started there. I can remember a problem that I had when I was doing research. You know, not all the times did I go down the right path. And I can remember I worked for Neptune on a thermoelectric flow meter. And that was a project I was hired for. It meant my job. And after I got studying to it, I had to tell the management they made the wrong decision. And I was so scared. Here I am, trying to finish my doctorate and everything else, to tell them my research is gone, it's wrong. Okay, it's heading down the wrong, and you better drop the project when you can. That's a tough job to admit that what you've been doing is it's not working out. But a true scientist will do that. Okay. Trouble is we don't have enough, I think, honest scientists to stand really up what they want, what they believe in. They will make stories up. I've seen it all the time. And the press is partly responsible. I can remember the press coming to me when there would be an oil spill and so on. I said there was a spill off of Watch Hill, when I was still doing all that work. And I said, not much is going to happen. The currents in that area take it out to sea and evaporate, and it won't do much harm. Well, they went and found somebody said it's going to do a lot of harm. This big spill in the Gulf that they had BP. Everybody's Armageddon. The world's going to come to an end. Well, I wrote a letter or an article to the local newspaper saying, no, it's not going to come to an end. In fact, in a couple of years, we probably won't even know that there won't be much evidence that is, was even there. They wouldn't publish that. They didn't want to calm down public fear. They wanted to stir it up to sell more papers. Well, what has happened?
No, we barely know it's there now.
Yeah. So it just, humanity is damning themselves.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. You know, they like to make a big thing out of a lot of these things, and Mother Nature has a wonderful way of taking care of herself, even with our intervention. And the thing is, it's like with global warming, you know, we've had ice ages and times of very warm periods in our climate. You know, you look at the days of the dinosaurs, it was actually warmer than it is now. And,
well, a lot
and
warmer. A lot warmer. A lot
know,
CO2.
Exactly. And it was, you know, but then as the Earth changed its orbit around the sun and started moving away from the sun, things began to cool. And, you know, then we end up with ice ages. What was it, 1880 or when Krakatoa went off? We had snow in July because of the volcanic ash that had covered the atmosphere. And they said...
Yeah, I would fear more from a catastrophe of the Earth is a large volcano taking off. But, you know, if Yellowstone ever blew its top, it would throw us back into the Ice Age. It's so big and massive, so much of it. It's interesting. I got on one of my slides here I'm reading. 1922, the Washington Post reported that Greenland's glaciers were fast disappearing back in 1922. So a lot of this stuff is not new, it's naturally occurring. It is naturally occurring. And nothing to do with man. And how egocentric man can be to think that he can control Mother Nature. And Mother Nature has the ability to heal itself. And if mankind is doing it, it's going to take care of man and herself. Okay? Nothing is... Mother Nature is so powerful that it can withstand all these variations. It heals itself. Produce more carbon dioxide, plants grow quicker, and then take up more carbon dioxide. Well, thank God for carbon dioxide. You know, we can eat vegetables, more vegetables. Heat the water up, we get more storms. Storm produces cloud cover, cools the earth back off, doesn't it? There's so
right.
many checks and balances in Mother Nature to think that we can upset that natural cycle is I just think egocentric.
Well, you know, they look at hurricanes as being something bad, but hurricanes are actually Mother Nature's version of an air conditioner.
This is right. It cools it off.
It cools
the water off, gets the upwelling going, mixes things up. And, you know, people have been talking about the Northwest Passage. I've got some statistics on that. It was first navigated by Roald Amundsen in 1903 to 1906, and again by Henry Larsen in 1942, sailed through the North Passage. In 1977, the Belgian sailor Wiley de Roos and his steel yacht Willy Waw sailed through the Northwest Passage single-handed. The single guy. My God, what a feat. In 1988,
yep.
Rick Thomas and his North Edger sailed through the east to the west. It hasn't happened so far this, you know, in recent years. So there's been a lot of passages there, and people say it's opening up. Well, of course it opens up. It historically has opened up.
Mm-hmm. It opens and closes.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the Nautilus went under the ice cap, it was measuring the depth of the ice, and it varied everything from 3 feet to 25 feet all over the place, depending on currents and What?
This is interesting, because when I worked that electric boat, I did a little study on how the submarines could break through the ice cap, okay? And we were thinking, you know, take the heated water from the nuclear reactor, melt and go up, or else just use the buoyancy tanks to rip through. Well, you didn't want to use all the nuclear reactor. You know, politically, that wasn't the best way, but we looked at it. And they ended up using the sonar to look at the thickness. And we discovered the thickness of the ice that had to be thinned out so that the buoyancy tanks could break through the ice. And that's exactly what they did. You know, so
yeah, I remember those pictures.
the ice, not the whole thing, due to the currents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember
so
those photographs.
Anytime we use in the submarine.
Yeah, it was amazing. The picture of the Nautilus in the middle of the ice with big chunks of ice on her deck,
what was considered science by a lot of people is not science. It's of all politics, and once something gets full of politics, it's hard to get people believing in the science. And there's too many scientists trying to make a living off the whole thing and willing to compromise themselves. And I'm ashamed sometimes to be called a scientist, because there's a brood of them that are out there that I wouldn't associate with at all for all the tea in China.
Yeah, it's...
It all comes down to it. That's been that way since the history of man. Man always just thinks he's so brilliant. You know, you used a phrase that I use a lot. I've always used a lot, and that's that the Earth heals itself. You know, things go in cycles. You know, we got spring, summer, winter, and fall. We don't go through a summer thinking that the Earth is just going to warm to a catastrophic level and go through winter thinking it's going to cool. We know that the cycle is going to repeat itself. And, you know, man trying to control all of this is absolutely hilarious to me. We're at the bottom of the second hour. This is Contending for Truth Radio. This is Saturday Symposium with Dan Wilson. And we've got Dan's dad, Dr. Mason Wilson, PhD, with us. And I'm going to let you guys go back to just talking. I wanted to make an announcement at the top and bottom of the hour. We got another half an hour left. So let's just keep rolling. Hand it back to you, Dan.
Okay. I remember, as I said, some of the early, when I was growing up, some of the things you'd bring back, you know, the pictures of the early space probes that would be landed on the moon, and the efforts that went up into that, and it was... during the early 60s was probably the hiatus of engineering. And, you know, when you were with EB and Pratt and Whitney, you know, how was it to be there at the bleeding edge of new technologies? There was so much that was developed in that period. You were working on the USS George Washington, right?
Well, yeah. Well, not too much work. We were looking at how to launch the missiles, whether to blow or try to get close enough to the surface so that you drive it through the water column or send an air pocket up, first or whatever. So there was a lot of looking on how these things could be launched while submerged. But, you know, I don't know if you have a following enough to answer people calling in questions. I'd be glad to field any questions that people might want to field coming in here. I don't know if you want to do that. But we talked earlier about the American Physics Society, and they were not climatologists, but they... I'll tell you what they have said. The IPCC's 2007 climate summary overstated carbon dioxide impact on temperature by 500 to 2,000%. Okay. That's what the public is buying. CO2 enrichment will add a little more than 1 degree at 0.6 degrees C to global mean temperatures by the year 2100. That is caused not by man, it's just natural warming. Not one of the key three variables whose product is climate sensitivity can be measured directly. And the value for all these variables are only based on something like Forrest published papers. And you can show, but you can overstate what's happening with the CO2. They talk about that there's a feedback that's positive. Well, in fact, actually, we found out that feedback on CO2 is negative, and that's Mother Nature reacting again. So there's sufficient evidence. And don't let people intimidate you that 1,000 scientists believe it, so you have to believe in it. Give me the physics. Give me the facts. Okay? Don't call me names, okay, or to destroy my reputation. Give me the facts, and I'll give you my facts. And if we were more like that in the world, we'd be much better off, and we probably wouldn't have some of the bad politics we have today. Give me the facts, okay? I say there's facts and there's politics. I just love that because politics don't use facts.
Well, that's what we've been saying on our other show, Parental Sovereignty, is that politicians just used the facts about the Republican Party, we could end all arguments and win hands down just by using the truth. We are, Scott, myself, and the rest of our group on Parental Sovereignty are all what we call Frederick Douglass Republicans because he started out as a slave and was for the first 20 years of his life. And he went from literally not owning his own body to being the top 1%. By today's standards, he'd be worth about $28 million at the time of his death. And he was an advisor for five presidents. He went from not owning his own body to being one of the leaders in women's rights, you know, just using him as an example shows that the democratic process just does not make any sense. And, you know, when we look at climate change and all this, is that I look at somebody like Al Gore, and Al Gore had made a bundle off of this global warming thing. You know, so has Obama, so has a bunch of other people, just by spreading a lie. And, you know, this is part of our goal is to bring our nation back to its origins. You know, placing Scott as a minister and has a Bible study, and we believe that God should be in the middle of this nation with, you know, and the Constitution. And base it start from, if we just return to that very basics, morality will return, and we'll solve a lot of our problems. And
certainly I believe in that. Our founding fathers believed in God, you know, and all the buildings in Washington attest to that. We have the Moses Ten Commandments on the front of the Justice Building, and all over. It's our founding fathers believed in a God, and now we can't do that anymore. religion is being forced out. Because, well, you know, when you want to have a dictatorship, you can only have one god, and that's a dictator. I'm looking at an interesting cover a number of years ago, about 5 or 6 years ago. It comes from the Investor's Business Daily, and they have titled on it, "The Coming Climate Dictatorship." Do I have to tell you anymore? Okay, and what is happening? Unfortunately, what's happened in this country has happened many times, and where democracies have fallen and dictators have taken over. Same steps are taken. It's scary. Do away with God, take care of the health care. Hitler did that. First thing he did to gain control of the people was give a national health care system. Similarities are very, very disappointing. And I'm glad I'm an old man. I'll be dead probably before all this comes to fruition, but thank God I'll be dead unless the American people wake up. And the trouble is that the younger generation is very, very cocky. The world's all they live in, and the older people don't seem to know anything. They don't want to take any advice. So they are rapidly buying up all this lies that are put out by the administration. And unfortunately, if they don't wake up real soon, they're going to be held in chains and bounded to a dictator where they won't even be able to talk. Now the military chaplains can't even mention Jesus. Can you beat that? What is a chaplain? Do away with them then. My goodness, we don't want to teach them Islam.
Well, that's what our president wants. And
You take a look at what he's appointed. They're all Muslims. Really. If you take a look at all this recent, they're all Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
It's shocking. Just for the heck of it, you want a wake-up call, you look at all the recent appointments, and even all his czars were all Muslims. Wake up.
I know. This is why Scott and I are on the air.
some people. Do you take any phone calls from people?
We do. This is a brand new show, though. So we're only getting the name out just now. So this is only our third episode, Scott? And so we aren't quite known yet, but we'll get our following going as time goes on, because what I'm doing is I'm kind of showing, this show is all designed to show the path that led us here. Where we were, for instance, in the early 60s, and, from Johnson, political changes that have been made. We had Dr. Huber on a few weeks ago, and he explained, we were talking about LBJ and his taking of Social Security and putting it into the general fund, and the Gulf of Tonkin fiasco that led into Vietnam. Then we talked about Nixon and then Carter administration, and how the evolution from the liberal side has led us to where we are today. And today we're advocating a push for local and state actions, where the federal government is too far out of whack right now. And the only way to combat that is on the state level and through on the local level, where we start if we can start building a conservative base from there and then build that to the state level and then tell the state, you know, have the state say, you know, we're going by the Constitution, and if you guys don't, and the federal government's not going to follow it, then the heck with you. We're going to do it. And because, you know, the Constitution does say that the state has the majority of the power, not the federal government. And the federal government is limited under the Constitution on what it can do. And this is what we're going to, what my idea of saving our nation is, to get back to a state level, and eventually through the state level we'll start coming up with decent people we can send to Washington, and then we can start the change on the federal level. But until we change the state level, we don't have a chance of doing the federal. And it's the reason why I've been making my post on my page. And, you know, for instance, Department of Homeland Security just purchased 1.5 billion rounds of hollow point ammunition. That is against the Geneva Convention, meaning it's going to be used against us. So the states need to defend themselves, and they need to build up a system where, in case of federal invasion, we can stop them. The military is also, well, the military is going pretty much towards us. We're finding out more and more that the our federal military is taking their oath to heart to uphold the Constitution. It's the politicians who aren't. So if, you know, there's a rift here, you're going to see the military side with us, and this is why Obama's defunding the military. This is why he's building up FEMA. I mean, FEMA and Department of Homeland Security, you know, buying weapons of war. During the last plane crash in San Francisco, I don't know if you noticed, but the Department of Homeland Security was there, and she was wearing the same flak jacket that was being worn by a Army Reserve soldier. So it's like, you know, these people do not belong getting into state business, and we need to start putting down our feet on a state level and saying, no, you aren't coming in here. We aren't allowing you. And we have that right under the Constitution. Another thing we're fighting is the Common Core, which is basically, it's the same thing as Hitler Youth. It's a program designed to dumb down American kids so when they grow up, they don't have the resources nor the tools to question what the government's doing. And that's their entire goal. Where, you know, Scott, you join in on, with me on this. On the Common Core. Are you there?
Well, yeah, definitely. You know, everything that the left ever wanted to do, they knew they had to pull up to the top. That's the difference between us. If I believed for 5 seconds we had an example in history or an example right now in any country of the world where a socialistic, very controlled from the top big superstructure kind of government worked, I'd be all for it, but it doesn't. And they've really done Common Core exactly the way they did Obamacare. You know, they put it together shifty-wise. They didn't give you all the facts, so on and so forth. And it is. We've got some great snowballs to throw back at the other side during the election.
And I keep saying this, you know, Dan, when we talked to Dr. Huber, when the one question I had for him is why didn't Mitt Romney use Common Core? I believe if any candidate that gets out and explains to his constituency exactly what Common Core is, I believe they need to be out explaining exactly what Obamacare is. I think they need to be out explaining where the government really, where these people really, really want to go. They spend their time lying about where they want to go and lying about who we are. You know, I tell you, you said some great things, and one of the big things was, you know, when they don't get their way, when they're not right, they start throwing names, and those are all tactics. But we're heading towards the top of the hour, and so we want to get some closing remarks in. Before the Bog Talk cuts us off from the internet, but I want to, Mr. Mason, I want to thank you so much for coming with us. We've had some great discussion. Your son told me to just call you. I called you Mr. Mason, Mr. Wilson. He told me to call you Mr. Wilson and not Dr. Wilson, but I am going to call you Dr. Wilson. You've had some great things to share with us. I've learned some about global warming. I didn't realize that the charts of the warming of the sun and the solar activity matched up so well with those of the warming here and some other things. But, you know, this is Contending for Truth Radio, and I always go back to the creation. And you took it back there, too, back to the creator. When you look at this, when you look at the creation, you look at the trees and the birds and the flowers and the human brain and the eyeball and the ears and the nose and the mouth and the little tiny little insects and the big large animals, and you put the whole thing together, it's blatantly obvious that there's a creator behind that. Everything is even got, every living thing even has its own little blueprint, that DNA. I'm surprised science even lets us know it's in there. Because to me, that's the final shoe to drop on whether or not there's a creator. But that's where it all goes back to. And when we look at this world in terms of it having been created and the perfection that's in it and the order that's in it, we can look at something like global warming and from the beginning know there's got to be something wrong. Because it's a whole lot bigger than man ever could imagine, and that's been the problem since the beginning of time. Man wants to be smarter than God, and there's so much to this creation. As much as we understand about the tree and the plant cell and the root and the leaves and the flowers, we still don't have all the information about the tree that we think we will. And in 200 years, if good Lord lets this earth stay around that long, science is going to know in 200 years that they were really, really stupid today. And it's been a great conversation. I want to hand it back to you and Dan to have closing remarks, and then we'll, when Dan closes it out, I'll play D-Rock Country's This Is God's Country, a powerful, powerful song. And I want to thank everybody that's been listening. Thank everybody that's joined us. If you're joining in archive or if you're joining live right now, it's been a great discussion. And again, Mr. Wilson, I want to thank you so much for being here. I'll hand it back to you, Dan, for closing remarks and close out. And when you say the word, I'll play the music.
Okay.
Interrupt just a little bit.
Yes,
God,
go ahead.
One of my favorite expressions from the Bible is in Genesis, and God made man unto his own likeness. He gave us the ability to almost create life, but do you think he's going to let us control the planet? So I'll finish now, Dan. I'll sign off. Love yous all, and have a good day.
Okay, thanks, Dad. What I'd like to talk, you know, say briefly on this global warming thing, there's a theorem that says, this complexity theorem, that says every time you double the complexity, the number of issues goes up exponentially. Well, the thing is, if we look at our climate and all the variables involved in it, the number of problems we have in forecasting it becomes almost infinite. So global warming, just by that nature, cannot be proven or disproven. It just does not make any scientific sense. And this is what I want people to understand, is that if we can't tell where a hurricane's going in 5 days, how in the world are we going to tell what our climate's going to be in 20 years? It's, you know, there are too many variables involved, and, you know, we got to stop getting off our high horses and thinking that we know everything, because we are just scratching the surface in when it comes to science. And we prove that every day. And just think about that. Think about when they're trying to tell you something pertaining to science and climate change and everything like that, is it doesn't make any sense. If, you know, you take two apples and, you know, you look at these two apples, are they identical? No, each apple's different. This is just off of one tree. Every one of us is different. We're made out of the same genetic code, but you look at every person and they're a little bit different. Why? Because of the complexity of the system. The only person who understands how everything works is God, and we are not him. But we have to, you know, we do know of his existence. All we have to do is look around to see that. And, you know, that's why as a nation we have to return to putting God in the center and not follow these false paths. Once we do that, we'll have a much better chance of saving this nation. And my final closing statement is, you know, think about that. Look at our past. Look at our, you know, present, our future. You know, we got to talk today on some interesting things like, you know, the Nautilus breaking through the ice cap and the change, you know, the thickness of the ice cap over the North Pole compared to Glacier Girl, who went down and is 300 feet underneath ice because of changes. And, you know, speaking as a, you know, a retired professional sailor, I can tell you the Gulf Stream changes by the day. We used to get maps daily, and the Gulf Stream would shift to the left, shift to the right. The eddies would move around. How we get all these things tie into the forecasting. And this is why we can't, you know, they said above average hurricanes this year. So far, we've only had three named storms. Why? Because some sand got kicked up over the Sahara Desert. And just to come, just if we follow even the birth of a hurricane, the life cycle of a hurricane is extremely complex. So global warming is way beyond anything we should ever be able to comprehend. And with that, and I'll close it and say everybody have a wonderful weekend, and we'll be talking to you next Tuesday night on Parental Sovereignty, and I'll see you next Saturday.
Guess that's it, mate.
Yep. Scott?
You know, Dan, I've got
the music going, but it's not great.
Okay.
There it goes.
Oh, all right, picked up. All right, good enough.
I pray on my knees every night. A leader starts seeing light. Cause the road that we're on ain't where we belong. We've gotten so far away from the truth. God has been and always will be the foundation of life's liberties. For Christians like me and you, it's high time we spread the news. We can't sit around anymore. Come on and stand up. Stand up and fight for what you believe in. This is God's country. God ain't leaving. Mm-hmm. Oh, no. In every church bell, choir that sings, his message of love still rings. Across the land, he's everywhere. He answers to our every prayer. Here in the U.S. of A. Come on and he's the way, yeah.